Okay, before we start today's class on theories and models, I wanted to come back to one slide from last course about the experimental design, because you remember that I got confused about this slide on the sample results about the experiment that compares pie menus versus linear menus. And the reason I was confused is because the tables here that give the target seek time, which is the time it takes to select a target, or the number of errors, I was expecting to see values for pie menus versus linear menus. So it would be a very simple experiment with one factor, menu type, linear, or what they call pie menus, which I call radial menus in the rest of that class. And in fact, there are two dimensions. There's another dimension called task type, pi, linear, and classified. And I hadn't read the paper in a long time, so I didn't remember what it meant. What they did is they considered that if you have a linear menu, there are some commands, types of commands that go well in a linear menu when there's a natural linear progression. If you have the different sizes for a font, or if you have maybe a list of windows in alphabetical order, or when there's a linear order, they consider that the task was of a linear nature. And then they also consider that because pie menus are circular, there are other types of commands that fit well a pie menu design, especially when you have commands with opposites. So if I have open, close, have another example. copy and paste. And so they considered that this was a task that was well suited for a pie menu. And so their hypothesis was not just pie menus are faster and fewer errors than linear menus. Their hypothesis that there was also a correlation with the task type. And so what you see here in the top left diagram is that if you're using a pie menu for a, I would call it pie-friendly task, the selection time is 220. If you're using a pie menu for linear type of task, the selection time is 218, which is very similar. They had another set of commands that didn't fit any of these models. They call it unclassified. And it's like when you have a random collection of commands. So here it goes to 240. Now, if you look at linear menus, if you have a linear menu with a pie-friendly task where you have things like open, close, cut and paste, the times go to 268, and for a linear menu it goes to 230. So this gives the significant values, and so here the difference is not significant, but here the difference is significant. And so what it means is that you can tell more than just say pie menus are better than linear. You can say overall this is better than that, but within each time you can still look at the details. So that's what this is all about. If you look at error rates, you have a similar trend in that the error rates between these two are not very different. But in the case here of linear menus, it goes to 0.88. So with linear menus, the error rates are overall higher than with pie menus. But then if you look by task type, you have small differences .4. So yeah, the two differences are significant here in both cases. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify this because I was not able to, I didn't have all the explanations. Yes?
It's funny to see that the pie menu are better with linear tasks than pie tasks.
Exactly. So a time menu with a linear task type is better than the linear menu with a
than the pie menu with a pie task. If you look at the same
row. The diagonal.
No, the row 220 and 218.
Yes.
So I don't understand why a pie menu is worse with a pie task.
Okay. But this is a case where this difference is not significant.
Okay.
So you know, it was just on average. That's how it turned out. But you cannot. You remember that when we say not significant, it means we cannot generalize from the what we observed on the sample to the overall population, right? Okay. Any other questions about this? Okay, so today I'm going to talk about a number of theories and models for human-computer interaction. So first I will talk a little bit about what we call a theory, a model, especially in that environment. And then we will look at theories and models in four categories. Perception and action, cognition and behavior, so this is more the human side of things. The last one will be software architectures, so it's more the computer side of things. And in between we'll talk about theories and models that really focus on interaction. Okay, so models and theories, these are words that we read all the times. Many papers tell you, here's a new model for this and that. So what do we call a model? A model is a simplification of reality. It's a description of reality where you omit some detail. So in that sense, it's an abstraction of reality. By abstraction, I mean that you ignore some aspects and you focus on some others depending on what you are trying to study. So the goal of the model is to be useful to studying a particular aspect of a phenomenon. And because you have to do abstraction, you have this conflict between precision and generality. So the more you abstract, the more you are trying to do something general, but the more details you lose, and so maybe the less relevant it becomes. If you want to keep a lot of precision, then probably your model is going to be applicable to only a small set of phenomena. And that's why there are so many models, because people are interested in very large phenomena that you can generalize over many things. The concept of learning, for example, is something that applies to many areas. Some models are very detailed when I talk about pointing tasks. It's, you know, it's working for pointing, but not for dragging or for even other simple actions. And so, you remember when I talked about instrumental interaction, I talked about these three levels of a model for interaction. But these three levels really apply to models in general, and even models in physics or biology. The first level, the basic model, must be able to describe reality to some extent. So descriptive power is the ability to represent at least some aspects of a phenomenon. Now what most people try to do is to have predictive models that allow you to anticipate the behavior. And that's really the basis for scientific methods. When we do hypothesis testing, it's because we have a model that allows us to make a prediction saying, well, I expect the pie menus to be faster than linear menus. I'm making a prediction based on what I know about, in that case, human movement. And so, especially in places like physics, you try to predict things with a lot of precision using equations. But it's not the only thing that I mean by predictive. You know, predictive can also apply to other things that you don't measure with numbers. Learning is a good example. I predict that if I use this process, you will learn things better than with this other process. In many areas, this predictive power can also be put to use to create what is called generative power, the ability to imagine new solutions to a problem. Now, this is where you shift from the field of science, especially natural science, where you are studying nature, to the field of engineering, where you are building things. And computer science and certainly human-computer interaction are more technological field than a natural science field. We do observe natural phenomena. When someone is sitting in front of the computer and typing and interacting, the phenomena can be observed with the scientific method. But the goal of all this in general is to be able to generate new things. It's by observing how people point that I can think, oh, a round menu would be better than a linear menu. And then I can put that to the test. So, in general, we're trying to create generative models. That's the takeaway message here. So, then there are things that are not really models. There are things that people call models and aren't models. There are things that are theories that are in fact models. So things are a little bit blurry because there is an implicit hierarchy. You know, a theory is something big and important. A model is not bad, but notations, for example, are just description languages. We'll see one called UAN, where its goal is really purely to describe things without any theoretical underpinning. So a lot of people confuse all these terms because they are used so generally that you have to be careful. And for example, let's see examples along the course. Now, when we move from model to theory, the goal of the theory is to be explanatory. So with a model, you describe, you predict, maybe it helps you create new things, but it doesn't tell you why it is the way it is. Now, a theory is trying to give you the explanation. And of course, theories and models go hand in hand. You know, you have a theory, and it uses a model to the model oftentimes operationalizes a theory. So here, the validity of a theory is not just that it's good at describing things and making predictions or being generative. It's also that it's also describing reality, explaining the real causes of the phenomena and how things work. So if you look at physics, we have very precise ways of predicting the time it takes for an object to fall or all of this, but we don't know what is gravity yet. So there are different theories in physics that try to explain the things we observe, gravity being one of them. But we still don't know which is right. But even though we don't know, the models we have work very well. Okay? And so, as I mentioned in the class last time, this notion of having theory, having models that allow you to test the theory, brought the notion of falsifiability by Karl Popper. And Popper says, you know, you cannot call something a scientific theory if you cannot disprove, missing R here, if you cannot disprove it through experiments. So if you cannot come up with an experiment that would prove your theory false, if it did get some significant results in some way, then you cannot call it a scientific theory. And so the idea here was to sort of draw a picket fence around things that we call scientific and things that we call unscientific. It doesn't mean the unscientific things are useless or uninteresting or wrong or whatever. But typically when you, you know, look at things like religion, well, unless someone finds a way to disprove religion, it won't be considered a theory, a scientific theory at least. But it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not interesting to study religion, but just with other methods. Now, there are a lot of places where people dispute the characteristic of being a scientific discipline in the sense of Karl Popper. Especially in human sciences like economics. Well, how do you run experiments in economics? You know, you cannot say, okay, we have this model that if you do this and that, the economy is going to get better. I mean, it's not things you can test in the way that we've seen before. You cannot take two countries. First, you won't be able to have two countries that are, you know, similar enough that you wouldn't have problem with the between subject design. And then, okay, we're going to run this country this way for 10 years and this one this way for 10 years and see what happens. It's hard. And so in the social sciences, it's in general very difficult to run experiments in this way. And so people say, well, then it's not a theory. And I'm not going to go into that debate, but I think it's an interesting question to have this metaphysics discussions on, you know, what is science, especially because in our world the role of science and experts has become really very big. When the politics don't, you know what to do, they turn to the scientists and they say, tell us. And there are things that scientists can tell and there are things they cannot tell. And what they tell doesn't necessarily translate into what you have to do or have to not do. This is a whole debate about, you know, the environment. There's a whole thing of, well, is the global warming really happening, yes or no? And now they call it climate change, so it's not necessarily warming up everywhere. And then, is it caused by humans, or would it happen anyway? And, you know, by and large we have, and scientists, because they are trained to be careful, and then never going to say we have proved global warming. They say, okay, well, all the facts we have, or 95 or 98 or 99.9% of the facts we have, point to that hypothesis. And that's one thing that is often misunderstood, and why people say, oh, but look, the scientists are not telling this, it's for sure, so, you know, why don't we take a bet and assume it's different. So I think there are a lot of interesting discussions to have around this, and if you're interested in those subjects, I think I pointed out before to Bruno Latour, a book called Science in Action, La Science en Action. He's a French sociologist who was, I'm not sure I should say the one of the first ones, but he's well known for having studied scientists, so sociologists or ethnographers, you know, oftentimes they go study ancient tribes or things like this. He studied a particular tribe called scientists, and when he went into research labs, he looked at how scientists work. And he's French, but the book that he made him famous, Science in Action, was first written in English and then translated to French. And it's a very interesting view on science and technology. For example, he talks about what constitutes a scientific fact. And there is this widespread impression that you know, the fact is there and the scientist discovers it. And what Latour says, well, no, that's not it. It's a fact becomes a fact that is accepted by everyone when it is accepted by everyone. It's not you discover it and then everybody says, oh, yeah. And he takes examples around things like the discovery of DNA, or there's another example running through the book that show how long it took for people to take it for granted, to go from a theory to a fact. And one way to track this is how people have to cite references when they talk about these things. So, you know, today you don't cite Darwin anymore when you speak about evolution, because it's considered essentially an accepted fact, or the structure of DNA. But for, you know, years and years, people had to reference this work because that was a way to support their hypothesis. So one last thing here is the notion of empirical law. And I put that in because we have talked quite a bit about Fitts' law, and we'll talk more about it. And an empirical law is an observation of a regularity without an explanation. So it's not a theory. When I have Fitts' law and this equation that, you know, movement time is proportional to index of difficulty, we don't know why it is the way it is. And there are dozens and dozens of papers that try to, that have models and theories about how is the motor control in the human and the coupling between visual control and visual perception and motor control to explain how is it that you get this relationship. But it's a case where we have a law that is so far not falsified, it works, it's predictive, but there is no theory that is what, yeah. There are several theories in fact, but none has been.
So empirical laws are only proved by experiments, supported by experiments, and not theories?
Yes. The thing is, once you have a law, then you try to build a theory, right? And the same thing happened with the law of gravity. You know, the early physicists, they took several objects, they dropped them, they measured the time, and they realized it was this curve, and so they came up with the law of gravitation, and then they tried. So it's starting from an observed regularity, same thing with observing the skies and the trajectories of the stars and etc., that then you build a theory to try to explain the law. Okay, so now we're going to go into a set of examples to illustrate what I consider a number of important models or theories in perception and action first. And in that section, I will talk about three things, something on visual perception, the ecological theory of perception from Gibson, of which we've talked already a bit, so I'm not going to go too much further here. Hicks' law and Fitts' law, talked a little bit about it already, and the kinematic chain theory from Yeguiyar. So by talking about perception and action, I'm interested in how people perceive the world around them and how they act on the world around them using their hands and limbs. And so I'm not interested in cognitive processes, and of course the brain is involved in these processes, but I'm not looking at them from the perspective of cognition, and we'll get to cognition in the next section. So one important theory in visual perception is called preattentive perception. And it starts from the observation that humans, but also animals, it's easier to test with humans, can recognize some visual features extremely rapidly. So I have an example here. So I'm going to flash an image for you. So how many horizontal blobs were they? Okay.
One or two.
You're cheating. Okay. Second experiment. Hello. How many horizontal blobs were there?
Many.
Several. Many.
There were like five, six.
Okay. So, you want to see the images? So, here is this image. There was one.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sure a number of you said two because you said, ah, no, one would be too easy. I missed something, right? Okay. So, the thing is, if you look at all these blobs, they're all black and they're all vertical except one is horizontal. And your brain picked that in a fraction of a second. Now in the other image, not only there are a few more horizontal blobs, there's one, two, three, four, five, six, so you were right. But more importantly, there are two different colors, there's gray and black. And because there's these two variations that go on simultaneously, our brain cannot pick up that information immediately. So, for psychologists, it's an interesting study. How come there are things I can pick up immediately and some that require more processing, right? So this is what pre-attentive perception is about. And there have been many experiments that show that if you have objects and you vary one characteristic, such as line orientation, the size of the blob like I did, length, thickness, size if you take, for example, squares or circles, curvatures of lines, cardinality, it's more complicated, but if you have lines, the endings, if they end with a dot versus a normal ending. Intersections, if you have a bunch of lines and only two of them intersect. Inclusion, U, blinking, movement direction, depth, direction to light source. People are able to pick differences in one of these dimensions with immediate perception. And what is interesting at the cognitive level here is we know that for the recognition to happen so quickly, you can only have one firing of the neurons that are involved. So you cannot have a complex process that scans the image or makes some processing. It has to be wired in our brain, essentially, right? And so, but then, as soon as you combine several such changes, as we saw in the example, there are interferences, and you're not able to do the task. Some combination still works, some don't, so people try to understand that. And in fact, neuroanatomy has shown that we have neurons that are wired to recognize vertical lines and others to recognize horizontal lines. So it's a case where a theory that is not trying to explain why it is the way it is, but observes the phenomenon and put all this knowledge and says, well, if one dimension changes, we can pick it up. More than one, in general, it doesn't work. Then people try to explain and look at what's happening in the brain, and they find things that they were not necessarily expecting. So the theory of pre-attentive perception was invented by Trisman in 85. And it does explain that there's parallel handling at the level of visual perception of these various dimensions. And as soon as this parallel handling cannot process all the information, then it goes to a different mode where you do sequential handling. And so for those images, the second image, if I leave it on the screen, you'll be able to do the task by just looking more or less, you know, horizontally or vertically, but in a sequential way. Now, interestingly, this was already kind of discovered or observed by people almost a century before, who came up with the Gestalt theory. So,
we'll see the thing here again.
So, in the principles of Gestalt perception, people had observed that there are general organizations of information that you perceive as a whole. One of them is common area when things are close together, and proximity, and connectivity. Here, when I have the circle, the line, and the word connectivity, you immediately sort of connect them together, right? So, for example, if you look at these different arrays of dots, what do you observe here? How do you perceive these three things? Are they all the same?
The same numbers, four dots.
Okay.
But with different spaces.
Okay. So different spaces. So first they're organized in a kind of grid. Okay? And so between the second and the third, or the second and the first, what's different?
Spaces between
yes.
The dots is different.
Well, the spaces are different, but how do you...
It's larger with the second one.
Yeah? So how do you see the second one? You don't see lines? I see horizontal lines. Mm-hmm. And the third one, it's a little bit harder because there are fewer dots vertically, but I see it more arranged in vertical lines. It's just by playing on the spacing. I mean, you all saw that the spacing was a bit different. But just by playing on the spacing, something that has no... Well, it has a structure on the left, but just a grid becomes a structure that is more horizontal lines first or vertical lines first in the third case. Right? And this is an example about connectivity and symmetry. So if I ask you which one of these graphs is symmetric?
Second.
Yes, the second is an obviously symmetric shape because you have the dots on the grid and then it's like these two triangles and something at the top.
It's now, the same.
Exactly, it is the same graph. Is that if you look at the arrows, there is an arrow here from 1 to 3 and 1 to 2. So it's 1 to 3 and 1 to 2, and etc. If you continue, it's the same graph. But just by displaying it this way, you will perceive a symmetry that you will not perceive in the other case. So these principles of Gestalt perception were studied, and it was done in a way of, okay, it's trying to understand what are the situations where you do this kind of grouping or attaching or connecting things together. And that turned into not only preattentive perception, which I was talking about, but Gestalt theory is something that also inspired James Gibson for the ecological theory of perception I'm going to talk about in a minute. The other thing is that these things are very important in the area of information visualization. Because when you use a computer to present information, it makes sense to try to use this knowledge about how we perceive things so that if you want to make things stand out or notice some symmetries or some patterns of repetition, to use the principles of gestalt perception and pre-attentive perception so things are perceived immediately. You don't have to process images to understand the content. And so for those of you, or all of you, I hope, will follow the course on information visualization. You'll get back to this, I'm sure. And so that gets us to the ecological theory of perception. That was created by James Gibson. His wife, Eleanor Gibson, was also a psychologist. She was more interested in children and learning. And she has done a lot of work after James Gibson died to explain and make his theory more accessible. And the fundamental hypothesis behind the ecological theory of perception is the notion of coevolution between the animals that are on the earth and their environment. I mean, why do we have senses in the first place? You know, we have eyes, we have ears, we can sense touch. Remember in the first class I talked about the senses. Well, this is all to interact with our environment. The tree doesn't need eyes. Only animals that move have eyes. It's, you know, how did that happen? So if you take the theory of evolution from Darwin, it's often seen as animals or species evolve to adapt to their environment. But in fact, and I believe even Darwin talked about the fact that at the same time, these organisms change the environment. And that's the co-evolution, is that you adapt to and you change the environment, so you adapt the environment to you. In fact, in a sense, life on Earth came, one of the critical factors to have life was to have oxygen. In the early atmosphere of the Earth, there was no oxygen. And then there was this little organisms that didn't need oxygen but were producing oxygen, and massive amounts of them created the atmosphere with the oxygen, and that made it possible for more advanced forms of life to develop. So you can take this notion of coevolution, you know, very far back, and I'm not a specialist, so I can certainly not speak very much to this, but I think what is interesting in Gibson's theory is this notion that we adapt the environment over time, at evolution scales, as well as we adapt to it. And so that's why he calls it the ecological theory of perception. It's because he's looking at the animal and its environment as a whole, which is very different from a lot of the approach where you take the animal out of the environment, you put it in a cage, and you put electrodes in its brain, and you test it. And in his approach, you want to study the whole system. And so he talks about behavioral pre-adaptation, the notion that our sensory systems and our motor systems are, through evolution, pre-adapted to the environment we are in. And is also... So that's an interesting point about the notion of parsimonious descriptions and elegant perceptual processes. Essentially, what he's saying is that if there are several ways to explain something, it's the simplest one that tends to be the right one. So there's a principle, I think I mentioned it in an earlier class, called Occam's razors. Occam's razor. So Occam, O-C-C-A-M, was a monk in the Middle Ages. And he had this principle that, you know, when you try to explain something, always take the simplest explanation that works. Now, this is something that is sort of, a metaphysical position. Why is it that, you know, it should be the simplest one? And what does simple mean, by the way? Because something that's simple to me may not be to you. I think there's an underlying idea that nature is parsimonious. It tries to do as much as possible with as little as possible. Or at least that the selection process of evolution tends to keep things that are simple. But it's something that is debatable. In any case, his approach has always been to try to find the simplest explanations to things we observed in nature. And so he did a lot of work on ecological optics. And I talked about that a little bit in the first class. And he said, you know, information, perception is about picking up information from the surrounding world. And he really talked about information pickup. In that, in his theory, your brain is equipped with neurons that directly extract this information. And in a sense, I was talking just before about the discovery that we have neurons that, you know, are wired to recognize vertical things and others horizontal ones, etc. It supports this hypothesis. But I think even more important than that, he did a lot of work on optical flow. If you look at all of our perceptual senses, they operate on detecting not the state of things, but the variations. The ears perceives waves. So wave is, by definition, something that changes all the time. Even vision, your eyes, and mine as well, they are not steady. Even if I look at you, my eyes are doing these micro movements. And it's the micro movements that allow me to see. In fact, people have made experiments that I find scary, where they attach to the eye itself a little mirror that compensates for the micro movements. So even if you move your eyes, because we cannot, you may not move your eyes unless we cut the cord, which try to avoid. So they did a system where they put a little mirror, so it would compensate for your motion. You would always see, in fact, the exact same thing. And if you do this, you lose your visual perception. You stop seeing. Another example is, I don't know if I mentioned that, did I talk about the cats? It's called hemlock. So this guy did an experiment where you take two newborn cats that have been kept in the dark from the day they were born. I mean, these are experiments I'm not sure people to do these days, but you keep them in the dark. And then you put them in a system where you have a vertical pole in the middle, and then a bar at the top that turns around. And then the two cats are attached at the ends of this turning thing. One cat is on the floor, so he can walk. But every time he walks, it can only walk turning around the center. And any of his movement is replicated to the other cat, which is at the other end of this bar. So the two cats experience the exact same motion. But one is active, he can walk, the other is in the air. And so you put the cats in this thing, and you turn on the light. And the cat that is active recovers his sight. He starts to see. But the cat that is passive stays blind. And so that shows that, you know, perception and action are strongly dependent and coupled. You need to, you know, if you don't move, you don't need to perceive. but if you move, you need to perceive, and it will develop your perceptual senses very quickly. Now, don't be too sad for the passive cat, because, you know, once you've done the experiment, you can release him, and he will recover his sight as well. And so the visual perception that Gibson studied in the ecological optics was, a lot of it was about not only what he calls the optical array, sort of a picture of what you see. Even in that area, he talks about many interesting things. The fact is, we don't see light. In fact, you shouldn't look at the sun, right? It destroys your eyes. So what we see is not light, and we don't see objects. I am not seeing this table. What I'm seeing is the reflection of the light on the surface of the table, right? And so in the optical array, in this snapshot of the world in front of us, what we see is an arrangement of surfaces reflecting light. And I can detect in this information a lot of things, like the fact that this wall is further away than this one. I can see that even if I have only one eye, I don't need stereoscopic vision. And I can tell by the fact that the further an object is, in general, the less light it will reflect, because the light scatters. So this wall, I can see perfectly that it's brighter next to the light than in the corner there. Objects that are farther away, I don't see their details as well, so they have fewer details. And so just looking at the information in the optical array, by considering it as information about how the light interacts with that surface, gives you a lot of information. But if you go one step beyond and you look at information that is dynamic, so that's what you call the optical flow, then of course you have a lot more information. And here, what he has observed is that the organisms extract invariance from this optical flow. And so this is a lot of what senses in general do. I was talking of hearing, where you have a sound wave that comes to your ear. Sound wave, by definition, changes all the time, but your ears extract an invariant, which are the fixed frequencies in the signal. So there is some of the same thing going on in visual perception. And I had talked about this example of that's on the cover of his book, of the bird flying over water. And in the optical flow, and that works for every moving object, when you move, objects go by you. And the one thing that doesn't move is the object in the direction of your motion. And so you don't need, you know, to do complex computation in your brain to know where you're going. You just need to extract a fixed point from the optical flow. I was at a conference a number of years ago where they were studying how people avoid objects. So if I'm in a room and I have to go from one corner of the room to the other, and I put obstacles, they were using just simple poles, but it could be chairs. So the question was, you know, what is the path you're going to take? Obviously, you avoid the objects. I mean, one thing that would work every time is I can go along one wall and along the other wall and I get to the corner. But that's not the fastest path. And so spontaneously, you will take the path that looks shorter to you. And what the researchers did is their hypothesis, I can give the details here, but had to do with the angle between you and the next obstacle. And they created a model where the path was predicted with a single differential equation. That had to do with minimizing the angle between you and the next obstacle or something very simple. And then they put system in a virtual reality system where they could simulate different configurations of the obstacles, and they could track people moving in this virtual space. And they found that they were doing, you know, almost exactly what their very simple model was predicting. And so, of course, this supports this notion of parsimonious processes. You probably observed that if you are in a city where the street plan is a grid, like in many cities in the US, it's less common in France. And so, and especially when the grid is not square, so you have long blocks and short blocks, so blocks or rectangles like this. And you go from A to B, and on the way from A to B, you are going to take one path because it looks like it's faster to go to say first the short block and then you have to do the long block. And if you then take the path from B to A, you will not retrace your steps. Now if you look the math, you've covered the same distance because it's called the Manhattan distance, right? But psychologically, you know, if I'm at the corner of a block and I need to go, so the block is like this, and I need to go there, I will take the one that has the smallest angle with where I'm going. That will put me away from the shortest path, and so I make the next decision again at the next corner, and that will change. And if you're on the way back, you will get a different path. So it's a similar thing that was happening in this obstacle course. And so Gibson has introduced two other important concepts, this notion of action-perception coupling, which I was talking about with this cat experiment. And again, as I said in the first class, things like touch, you cannot really feel the shape of an object if you're not able to touch it. For objects that are far away, it's very hard to tell their distance or relative distance without moving. I reviewed a thesis recently where they were studying how you evaluate not the distance of an object, but something simpler than that. I put an object on the table and I give you a stick, right? And you're not able to move your body, to move forward. You have to sit and not. And I give you the stick and I ask you, can you reach the object with that stick, yes or no? And then you are allowed to try. And they discovered that if you don't allow people to move their head, they perform much more poorly than if you allow them to move their head. So you need motion of your body to assess depth. And I think this action-perception coupling is really a basic phenomenon in the way we interact with the world, and that's why it's so important in graphical interfaces to have good feedback. So you get this similar type of experience with a computer interface.
And finally, Gibson introduced the notion of affordance, which is a hard concept to grasp, but is this idea that builds on this notion of information pickup. And when you are trying to achieve a goal, you will immediately perceive the capabilities of the environment to help you achieve this goal. So the type of experiments that have been done is I build a wall and I make several openings in the wall of various sizes. And then I tell the subject, you have to go on the other side of the wall and observe which opening they will take. And it seems so obvious to us that, you know, we don't even think that this is of any interest. You know, you obviously go for the opening that is big enough for you to go through. And that works perfectly, of course, with animals. So the affordance for passing through an obstacle is something we perceive immediately. If I'm in this room and I don't know, the light goes off and I need to go change the bulb, immediately objects like the tables and the chairs will have affordances for this operation, even though in general I'm not supposed to step on the chair or step on the table. But, and that's the key thing about affordance, it's not a property of the object itself. It's a relationship between the property of the object and the goal I want to achieve. Right? And so if my goal changes, the affordance change. And one extra piece of that is the notion of tool. Tool use, interestingly, is pretty rare in the animal kingdom. There are very few animals that use tools. There are examples of monkeys that know how to use a rock to break a coconut. There's also another animal that likes ants that live in the ground, so it can take sticks and put it in the ant. And there's also animals who know how to go get honey out of, what's it called, honey, what the bees build, in a ruche. And they know how to use a stick to get that honey without being stung by the bees. So there are a few examples. But humans have really developed tools. And the thing about tools is that once you have a tool, the affordances of the environment change. Once you take your pen, things become writable. That includes your paper, but also the table and the wall. Right? Now, well, then there are social rules that... but many students write on the tables, you know. So it's really a strong affordance. So I think these are really interesting theories, and they are often cited for people who design human-computer interfaces, trying to create affordances on an interface is usually a good idea. And we talked about, did we? No, we didn't talk about metaphors. That will be for the next class. So we'll get back to affordances again in the class on conceptual modeling. Okay, now we get to Hick's law and Fitt's law. So these are both empirical laws, as I described earlier, extracted from control observations. So we talked about Fitt's law already. Time to acquire a target, linear in the index of difficulty, that itself depends on distance to target, or the amplitude of movement, and the width of the target, or pointing tolerance. One of the theories to explain, this is an interesting thing. One of the arguments for Fitt's law and what
triggered Paul Fitts to describe it the way he did and study it the way he did was based on the information theory by Claude Shannon. So you know Shannon theory? That was really extremely important work in the 40s. Without that, we wouldn't have cell phones and networks today, probably. So he was looking at the information capacity of a communication channel. And Paul Fitts looked at pointing as the way of producing information. So you're transmitting information to the environment, because he was studying pointing on the table, or to the system. And in fact, if you look at this equation and you have a vague memory of Shannon's formula, the capacity is proportional to the log of the ratio of signal to noise. And here, signal would correspond to distance, which is the amplitude you're trying to cover. So you're trying to say, this is this target I'm trying to reach, not this one here or this one further away. But it's but I have a certain tolerance. I accept a certain noise, which is the width of the target. I don't have to hit the exact center of the target. I have a little bit of tolerance. So the D over W is really comparable to the signal over noise that you have in Shannon's theory. And then, of course, since to point you need to control the motor system, it's not too surprising that you know you're sending signals to your muscles, and there's also some noise that reduces the precision. So I have another class. I was planning to do it today, but I don't think we'll have time, so I'll do it next time, where we'll look about Fitts' law and how it applies to pointing techniques in more details. Let me go back now to Hicks' law, which is also an important one, because this one has to do with choosing or selecting an object, but mentally selecting. So Hicks' law measures, predicts the reaction time. If I show you a number of items and I ask you, is item X in that list or not? The reaction time, the time it will take you to say yes or no, would be proportional to the log of the number of items. So it's a recognition task. It's purely visual. You just have to click a button to say yes or no. So what I find interesting is that in many of these psychophysical laws, you find a log relationship somewhere. If you look at hearing, for example, we measure the loudness of a sound with a log scale as well, the decibels. It's a log scale. So a lot of our senses are somehow using log transforms, which is another interesting observation. So the argument with Hicks' law is that you can use Hicks' law to improve things like what would be the best size for a menu, for example. Is it better to have a long menu or several short menus? So if you do two, if you have to pick a menu in a menu bar and then an item in the menu, you can make prediction in terms of recognition, not the time it takes to then make the selection, which would then involve Fitts' law, but you can look at what are the best trade-offs. And there are a number of people who have really used these two laws and other ones, and I don't have the steering law here. There is another law called the steering law that predicts the time it takes to move to trace, to move your pen on your paper or the cursor on the screen while staying inside a specific area that's called the tunnel. So imagine the tunnel, you have to enter at one end, stay inside the whole time and get off at the other end. So by using Fitts' law, I'll show that next time, you can make a prediction of how long it takes to do this kind of constrained movement. And so people have been using a combination of Higgs' law, Fitts' law, and this steering law to have pretty good predictive models of selection, selecting in a set of menus, for example. So that's why these things are interesting. There are very few quantitative laws in psychology. And the ones that we have are mostly laws of motion, of movement. So that's why these are really important. And the last bit on the action and perception thing is the kinematic chain theory, which is due to Yves Guillard, a French psychologist. And I've been lucky enough to work with him quite a bit. In particular, we worked together on bimanual interaction, which is what this is about. And we also worked on pointing and navigation and zoomable interface, and I will talk about that in the next class. So what Yves Guillard did in this work is look at how humans use their two hands or their two upper limbs. And in classical psychology, it's always been seen as your left or non-dominant hand is a poor right hand. They are the same, but you're less good with your left one than your right one, if you're right-handed. But if you look at the way people use their two hands, and you can also look at animals, you'll find that they have different roles. So I know Guillard takes the example of a particular type of lobster, you know, lobster animal that lives in the water, and they have two claws, right? And this particular, the number of species where the two claws develop very differently. One becomes very big and strong, and the other stays small. And the reason is because when they eat other animals, they use one of their claws to hold it, and the other was to crush it. And so it's the same thing with humans, is that we use our two hands for different things. And what he observed is that in general, the dominant hand was used after you used the non-dominant hand. So you use the non-dominant hand, the left hand for a right-hander, first to set what he calls the frame of reference. So to hold the object onto which the right hand is going to operate.
Like paper.
So like paper, and I talked about this little experiment where you ask people to write notes and you put a stencil so you can see where they wrote relative to the table. And spontaneously people would move the paper with their left hand. So even though you write the whole page in the context of the table, it will cover about, you know, the equivalent of 10 lines. But there are many, many tasks in everyday life where we have this asymmetry. And so what a kinematic chain is the fact that if you take the arm, you have a series of joints from the upper arm, to the palm, to the fingers, and the fingers themselves have three knuckles. And in an articulated system, the upper part of the chain, which is called the distal part, naturally have a larger amplitude, but smaller precision. And so as you go from the upper arm to the lower arm to the wrist to the hand to the knuckles, you have less and less amplitude and more precision. So with this articulated body, we can have very precise motions with a very large amplitude, because we combine the amplitude from the distal part with the precision from the proximal part. And what Yves Guillard said is, what if we considered that instead of having a body with two kinematic chains for the two upper arms, we considered that the left arm, the non-dominant arm, was sort of upper in the kinematic chain, higher up than the right or the dominant arm. So instead of having a symmetric system, you have one asymmetric system where the left hand is there to set the context, and you go down towards the right hand that acts with precision. And that is a theory that is supported by the observation that the non-dominant hand acts first, establishes a frame of reference, does not need to be precise, and the dominant hand acts after the non-dominant hand, within the frame of reference that it establishes. I'll correct the typo here. So, acts after the non-dominant hand. Now, of course, it's scrolling, so... that still fits. And there was another typo somewhere here. Okay, so now this is a very nice theory, and it has been used in a number of user interfaces. You remember in the video I showed last time, the CPN tools video, where we were using tool glasses, so the notion that you have this transparent tool palette that you move with the left hand, and then you use your right hand to click through. Very much like, you know, you have a ruler and you would use your ruler, presumably with your non-dominant hand, to draw a line with your right hand. But we did some studies and we also found some tasks that were more efficient when the hands have symmetric roles. So we did a task which was... you have a rectangle on the screen, and you have two rectangles, and you have to align them. So take one rectangle and move it over to the second one. And we tested two conditions. One was the symmetric assignment, where your two hands are controlling the two corners of the rectangle, and you have to put it on top of the first one. And the asymmetric condition, where one hand is controlling the position of the rectangle, so you're just moving it, and the other hand is controlling the size, you're just scaling it. And what we found is people were faster with the symmetric assignment, the two corners, rather than the asymmetric one. So it looks like we would have falsified the theory, or at least shown that there are situations where the symmetric assignment works better. Now things are a little bit more complicated than that, because in the task, in what we had called the asymmetric assignment, the two hands needed to have equal precision. So it was not really following the principles that I've mentioned here, and you couldn't really do the two operations in sequence, because you would typically first move the shape sort of where you think it should be before you resize it, But then as you resize, you would realize you had to adjust. So that's not, you know, but there has been other work following that showed that we can also be very good with symmetric rolls. So it's an example where, you know, many of these theories have a domain of validity that is pretty small. When I talked about Fitts' law, and we'll come back to this again, you know, Fitts' law works if you have something that is of the amplitude of the arm. If I put the target at the other end of the building, Fitts' law won't apply, because, you know, even if you run as fast as you can and don't hit anybody, or if you do this outdoors, as soon as the speed, the maximum speed, is limited, Fitts' law just doesn't work anymore. So, you know, many of these laws have domains of validity that are limited, and studying that those limits is interested in itself.
Can I ask you about the falsification of a theory? Does it mean that a theory has to have an exception in order to be a theory? Or because I didn't quite understand. So.
No, when you falsify, what you try to do is to design an experiment where if the experiment... yeah, I think you were not here for the class on last...
No.
Yeah. Okay, so you'll have to go through the audio for this one. But the idea is that you try to prove the theory false, because we cannot prove that something is true, that the theory is true. Okay. Yeah, so I had talked about it a little bit already, but last class was really all about that. But what happens with falsification in general is, it's not that the theory is 100% true or 100% false. And what usually happens is you design an experiment, it disproves your theory, and then you adapt your theory, you refine it. Or you say, well, it means that this is outside its domain of validity. It doesn't mean it's wrong, it just doesn't apply to this case. So last time we talked about, you know, relativity theory being a refinement of Newton mechanics. Because if you take the equations from Einstein and you have small speeds relative to speed of light, you do a little bit of approximation and you get classical mechanics. So it's not that classical mechanics is wrong, it works very well for many things, but we found a way to refine it. And we've shown that classical mechanics is not valid for objects that go near the speed of light, and you have to use that other theory in that case. So I would say here we have a similar kind of thing where, whether it's for Fitts' law, well, Fitts' law works in many situations, but if you have targets that are very, very small or distances that are very, very large, it won't apply. So we know it's domain of validity. Here with the kinematic chain, it's the same thing. We know that there are some tasks where a symmetric assignment will work better. It's not that the asymmetric one does not work. There are many cases where it works. The one where the symmetric works better is the one for which we haven't found, I think, the best asymmetric one. So things are, you know, always more subtle than you want them to be. And so that's what the process of falsification is about, is trying to really improve your theory rather than say, oh, I have to throw it away. Sometimes it happens that things are thrown away, but the process, and again, that's something that Bruno Latour talks about, is really a long process of knowledge building and the social process, really, of agreeing about things. It's not all completely deductive, and because if it were, it could have been done by machines, and I wouldn't have a job, so... Okay, so I can go through this next section, or we could have a break if you want. I wouldn't mind a break myself, so.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? Okay, so let's do 15 minutes till 11:15.